This is day four of this October 2017 seven-day session. We're going to take up a new text today, a new old text. This is called Swampland Flowers, and the subtitle is The Letters and Lectures of Zen Master Da Wei. The 12th century Chinese Zen master. I'll forego the biographical material about him just because I don't think we need to do it every time, but I'll say this much. He, like Hakuin after him, became known as a great reformer of the Rinzai tradition of Zen, the Rinzai lineage, in particular the koan system. Hakuin was in the 18th century, Da Wei, as I said, the 12th century, but he's credited with having really brought a somewhat weakened line back to life. It's very highly regarded, especially in the Rinzai or Linchi tradition. So we'll just start off with his first entry here. He quotes the Buddha. Never a bad way to start. The Buddha said, if you want to know the realm of Buddhahood, whenever we see the word Buddhahood, we can just substitute enlightenment, full enlightenment. If you want to know the realm of Buddhahood, you must make your mind as clear as empty space and leave false thinking and all grasping far behind, causing your mind to be unobstructed wherever it may turn. The realm of Buddhahood is not some external world where there is a formal Buddha. It's the realm of the wisdom of a self-awakened one. Mind as clear as empty space. I think one of the all-time great analogies for the functioning of the mind, small m, and mind, capital M, is clouds in the sky. If you think of clouds as thoughts, other phenomena of the mind, behind it is our true mind. The thoughts come and go, floating by here and there, obstructing the view of this clear, bright sky. Behind it is this realm of the changelessness, the ground of mind, as Muso Kokshi put it earlier in our text, the sesshin, the ground, the basis, the unchanging reality. You must make your mind as clear as empty space. Doesn't mean we have to get rid of the thoughts. It really means to not be caught up. It doesn't mean we have to get rid of the clouds. It just means we have to not get involved with the clouds. And then it's as if those clouds were no clouds. As Hakuin said, our thought now being no thought. If we don't attach to thoughts, then it's as if they're not there. Leave false thinking. That would be, I think, false thinking, we could say, would be any time we're just having random, irrelevant thoughts. I mean, there's thinking, as distinguished from thinking is a way to use the mind in a way to that we sometimes do, planning or solving problems. But false thinking is just being lost in thoughts that just are trafficking in the mind. Leave false thinking and all grasping far behind. Grasping. Grasping is a great word and a great tendency to be aware of. It springs from desire, from attachment to something that we want to get for ourselves. That's different from just the basic aspiration to know ourselves, to know who and what we are. That's grasping is something else. It's wanting, seeing something as an object outside us that we want to acquire, and that's delusion. With respect to, let's say, mu, then a koan like mu, there's no point in grasping it because it's really nothing there. It's not outside us. It has no substance to it. We don't need to grasp it. We just need to bring our full attention to it, our steadfast attention to it. The realm of enlightenment is not some external world where there's a formal Buddha. It's the realm of the wisdom of a self-awakened one. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. It's really the sky, to go back to that analogy. It's the clear, cloudless sky, but it's also the whole sky with the clouds. He goes on, once you are determined that you want to know this realm, you do not need adornment, cultivation, or realization to attain it. What does he mean? You don't need realization. Well, you could say that realization is just a synonym for awakening or enlightenment. I think what he means is you don't need anything because it can't be attained. It can't be attained because we are it. We are this enlightened nature, this true mind, this original nature. You must clear away the stains of afflictions from alien sensations that have been on your mind since beginningless time, so that your mind is as broad and open as empty space, detached from all the clinging of the discriminating intellect, and your false, unreal, vain thoughts, too, are like empty space. There it is again, our thought now being no thought. Then this wondrous, effortless mind will be unimpeded wherever it goes. This wondrous, effortless mind. Zen Master Dogen said, realization is effort without desire. Really, effort without grasping, craving. What does that mean in practical terms? Say you're following the breath. It means just following the breath, becoming one with the breath. Doesn't require craving or desire of any kind, just being the breath or being Mu. It means looking. Looking is not the same as desire. But true looking does take effort. He continues, he's quoting someone, but he doesn't say who he's quoting. Just get to the root. Don't worry about the branches. He's not quoting Muso Kokshi because he preceded Muso Kokshi, but Muso Kokshi didn't make up the root analogy. Just get to the root. Don't worry about the branches. We talked about the root earlier, the Sesshin, the essential, the one, the none. The world of non-differentiation, the fundamental, that's the root. He goes on, emptying this mind is the root. Once you get the root, the fundamental, then all kinds of language and knowledge and all your daily activities as you respond to people and adapt to circumstances through so many upsets and downfalls, whether joyous or angry, good or bad, favorable or adverse, these are all trivial matters, the branches. That is, he said, once you get the root. If you can be spontaneously aware and knowing as you are going along with circumstances, then there is neither lack nor excess. Once you get the root, the fundamental, then all these things, the upsets and downfalls and so forth, are all trivial matters. We find this in Sesshin. If we can hold fast to the one practice we're working on, then the ups and downs of Sesshin, the discouragement, the stale periods, and the better periods where we feel possibly elated, these all are seen as just passing phenomena. They recede in importance. They go into the background. We see them. We see that we're more concentrated on this afternoon and less concentrated this morning and all. But they're all so sort of beside the point. Sesshin is... It's just a steady process of encountering one state of mind after another and just slicing through them, not getting snagged in any of them, recognizing that they all pass. He continues, since you're following this path, then at all times in your encounters with people and responses to circumstances, you must not let wrong thoughts continue. If you cannot see through them, then the moment a wrong thought comes up, you should quickly concentrate your mental energy to pull yourself away. If you always follow those thoughts and let them continue without a break, not only does this obstruct the path, but it makes you out to be a person without wisdom. You should quickly concentrate your mental energy to pull yourself away. This, I believe, is the very point of distinction between Zen meditation and Vipassana meditation. In Vipassana meditation, they would generally say, when you notice a thought, just watch it until it disappears. Whereas in Zen, I don't know that I would say you pull yourself away. You swing your attention back to the practice you're working on. You redirect. I think it's not a significant distinction, but it is a real enough distinction. We learn how vital it is in how we direct our attention. So much depends on that. So much of the quality of our life in terms the way that the past can get stuck in the mind, past events, it's essential that we not linger in them, especially the unpleasant things. Let's say we make a bad investment of some kind and lose some money. Well, right there, we have a choice of whether to dwell in that mistake or just let it go. And right there is how the quality of our life is determined. Right, how we choose, where we choose to direct our attention, whether it's back there with that investment or that little skirmish, verbal skirmish we have with someone, or to keep it here, right here. And this is all that is real, this moment. Why would we want to linger in our thoughts, especially unpleasant thoughts, but even pleasant ones? There, well, that's more obvious, why we'd want to dwell in pleasant memories. But it doesn't work in the long term. Doesn't serve us. It does not lead to peace of mind, even dwelling in pleasant past memories. In the old days, he quotes encounter. Kueshan asked Lazi An, "What work do you do during the 24 hours of the day?" An said, "I tend an ox." Kueshan said, "How do you tend it?" An said, "Whenever it gets into the grass, I pull it back by the nose." Kueshan said, "You're really tending the ox." He then Da Wei comments, "People who follow the path in controlling wrong thoughts should be like Lazi An tending his ox. Then gradually a wholesome ripening will take place of itself." So yeah, it's just the same. You notice the mind has drifted. You just redirect. Bring the attention back to this breath, koan. It's that simple. It is that simple. Two-step process. First, the noticing that the mind has wandered, and then bringing it back to the practice. Tirelessly, persistently. continues, matters of worldly anxieties are like the links, of a chain joining together continuously without a break. If you can do away with them, do away with them immediately. Because you have become habituated to them since beginningless time, to the point where they have become totally familiar, if you don't exert yourself to struggle with them, then as time goes on, without your knowing it, they will have entered deeply into you. Finally, on the last day of your life, you won't be able to do anything about it. If you want to be able to avoid going wrong when you face the end of your life, then from now on, whenever you do anything, don't let yourself slip. If you go wrong in your present doings, it will be impossible not to go wrong when you're facing death. Well, this course requires requires mindfulness, and it requires self-discipline. He continues, the mind, discriminating intellect, and consciousness of practitioners of the way should be quiet and still 24 hours a day. When you have nothing to do, you should sit quietly and keep the mind from slackening and the body from wavering. If you practice to perfection over a long, long time, naturally, body and mind will come to rest at ease, and you will have some direction in the way. Imagine how this contrasts with contemporary modern culture. When you have nothing to do, you should sit quietly and keep the mind from slackening and the body from wavering. What owner of a smartphone is going to do this? Sit quietly and keep the mind from slackening. We have such an uphill battle with these devices. I was recently in Sweden, and on the subways, just about every person on the subway has their head bent down over their smartphone. And I just commented on that, and one of my students there said, yeah, younger person in the Sangha there said, yeah, if you're sitting on the subway and you're just sitting, people think you're schizophrenic. What chance do we have, really? We really have to be willing to just cleave to what you know is best, that will lead to freedom, and not be concerned what other people think. But it's a lot more than that, because there is this force of habit. Here, too, it takes discipline, self-discipline, to not abuse these devices by just reflexively going to them whenever we have a spare few seconds. There's some words from an Ursula Le Guin in her book, The Farthest Shore, where she says, discipline is the channel in which our acts run strong and deep. Where there is no direction, the deeds of people run shallow and wander and are wasted. He continues, "This matter may be taken up by brilliant, quick-witted folks, but if you depend on your brilliance and quick wits, you won't be able to persevere. It is easy for keen and bright people to get started, but hard for them to preserve it. That's because generally their entry is not very deep and the power is meager. With the intelligent and quick-witted, as soon as they hear a spiritual friend mention this matter, their eyes stir and they are already trying to gain understanding through their mind's discriminating intellect. People like this are creating their own hindrances and will never have a moment of awakening." This was what Yung Chia, he's a famous Chinese master, what Yung Chia meant when he said, "The loss of the wealth of the Dharma and the demise of virtue all stem from mind's discriminating intellect." Misusing it, of course. We need to use our discriminating intellect many, many, many times a day to discriminate between this and that in the most obvious ways. We need to discriminate between a red light and a green light. We need to discriminate in all manner of ways. But so much of our time, our use of the discriminating intellect is unnecessary. And then he drives it home here in the next paragraph. "The obstruction of the path by the mind and its conceptual discrimination is worse than poisonous snakes or fierce tigers." Why? Because poisonous snakes and fierce tigers can still be avoided, whereas intellectual people make the mind's conceptual discrimination their home. There's never a single instant, whether they're walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, that they're not involved with it. As time goes on, unknowing and unaware, they become one piece with it. And not because they want to either, but because since beginningless time they have followed this one little road until it's become set and familiar. So this is the habit force of just lapsing into thought all the time. Though they may see through it for a moment and wish to detach from it, they still can't. Thus it is said that poisonous snakes and fierce tigers can still be avoided, but the mind's conceptual discrimination truly has no place for you to escape. This word escape especially brought to mind a story I haven't read in a long time. This is by a Belgian, 19th to 20th century Belgian by the name of Maurice Maeterlinck. "If you place in a bottle half a dozen bees and the same number of flies and lay the bottle down horizontally with its base to the window, you will find that the bees will persist till they die of exhaustion or hunger in their endeavor to discover an escape through the glass, while the flies, in less than 2 minutes, will all have sallied forth through the neck on the opposite side. It is the bees' love of light, it is their very intelligence, that is their undoing in this experiment. They evidently imagine that the escape from every prison must be there where the light shines clearest, and they act in accordance and persist in too logical action. To them, glass is a supernatural mystery they have never met in nature, They've had no experience of this suddenly impenetrable atmosphere. And the greater their intelligence, the more inadmissible, more incomprehensible will the strange obstacle appear. This is Zen practice. This is pretty much any of us, actually. Never mind highly intelligent people, but pretty much any of us with our attachment to the intellect as something that we think will help us resolve the great matter. Whereas the feather-brained flies, careless of logic as of the enigma of crystal, disregarding the call of the light, flutter wildly hither and thither, and meeting here the good fortune that often waits on the simple, who find salvation there where the wiser will perish, necessarily end by discovering the friendly opening that restores their liberty to them. Perfect metaphor for what we're doing here is it's all about becoming simple, simplifying the mind. We've woven ourselves into this net of duality, and now the only way out is really out of this self and other, us and them, right and wrong, success and failure, all of these dualities. The only way out is to allow this discriminating mind to come to rest. And then, after Sesshin, using it as we need it. But here, just finding a way to see what is beyond this discriminating mind. And it comes through just this pure, simple-minded concentration, single-minded and simple-minded concentration. Roshi Kaplow used to quote one of the monks in a monastery in Japan as saying, "You must become a mu simpleton, or a mu idiot." Mu has never been figured out by anyone. You're not going to get anywhere with it by trying to understand it with the intellect. But an understanding will come when we become one with the koan, whether it's mu or another koan. Continues, gentlemen of affairs. I guess that means people with responsible jobs. I don't know. Another odd translation. I think a little too literal. Often take the mind, which assumes there is something to attain, to seek the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain. What do I mean by the mind which assumes there is something to attain? It's the intellectually clever one, the one that ponders and judges. Or we can say the mind that strategizes, calculates, rehearses. Look, even during Sesshin you'll see this mind, this strategizing, calculating, rehearsing mind always ready to run wild. And this, as Da Wei was saying just a minute ago, We are so habituated to this kind of background, reflexive, judging, evaluating, strategizing, and so forth, that we often don't know it. We're not aware that we're embedded in it, just as a fish doesn't know it's in water. So the first all-important step in Sesshin is coming to notice how much we flee into thoughts automatically and the force of habit behind it. And then when we can start to notice this, then we can have some choice in the matter as to where we want to have our attention. What do I mean by the Dharma wherein there is nothing to attain? It's the imponderable, the incalculable, where there's no way to apply intelligence or cleverness. An ancient worthy had a saying, "Transcendent wisdom is like a great mass of fire. Approach it and it burns off your face." Dawei often seems to quote people without attribution. Approach it and it burns off your face. Face. The concept of face has a lot of significance in Asia that is not something we can easily understand. In this case, approach it and it burns off your face would mean erases that which sets us apart as separate from others. He continues, "If you hesitate in thought and speculation, you immediately fall into conceptual discrimination." Jung Chia said, he already quoted him earlier. Yeah, he kind of repeats himself here. Just to say this, that this transcendental wisdom, this great mass of fire, burns off your face. What we're approaching in Zen practice, especially Sesshin, is our original face. It is without form, without features. There's a koan in the Mumon Kan, number 4, I think. It goes like this: "Why does the Western barbarian have no beard?" He continues, "Once you have the aspiration to investigate this path to the end, you must settle your resolve and vow to the end of your days not to retreat or fall back so long as you have not yet reached the great rest, the great liberation." There's not much to the Buddha Dharma, but it's always been hard to find able people. The concerns of worldly passions are like the links of a chain joining together without a break. Those whose resolve is weak and inferior time and time again willingly become involved with them. They are dragged along by them. Only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower will he consent to step back. wisdom and willpower. Wisdom to discern the difference between thoughts and no thought. And then the willpower to choose no thought, no mind, mu, breath. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.